So he's at Accenture, and he, Jay, again, very charismatic, personable guy. He's able to convince the higher ups at Accenture to essentially carve out this position that didn't exist within the company. And Accenture is as corporate of a corporate job that exists, right? I mean, to your point, it's management consulting. It's could not be any more white collar. But he convinces these higher ups to essentially become a consultant within Accenture and leading these kind of spiritualism developments and, you know, advising other higher ups on their spiritual growth and kind of helping them grow their social media brands. What I've heard since this story published from people who worked at Accenture at the same time is that Jay wasn't doing much management consulting there. He just, he managed to become like an in-house guru, essentially. And he writes about this in his book. In his book, you know, he led a huge meditation. I think they had it at Wembley Stadium. They were doing some kind of large company offsite, and you know, on the pitch there, he's leading thousands of people in a meditation. So Jay was also kind of making content at this time. Content catches the eye of Arianna Huffington. Arianna brings him to New York. He starts hosting HuffPost, show on HuffPost Live. And Jay basically rode the wave of pivot to video in the mid-2010s. So the thing that really kind of elevated him at first was that, so he's with Arianna Huffington for a little while. He quickly realizes, like, you know what? I don't need the backing of a media company. I can do this on my own. So he breaks out on his own and starts creating his own content. And it just goes crazy viral on Facebook. So, but there's something important to kind of point out there here. And it's kind of in the weeds about digital media and technology. So 2015, 2016, 2017, when Jay is really kind of starting to generate a large social media following, specifically on Facebook, that is when Facebook was trying very hard to compete with YouTube as the center for video on the internet and making lucrative deals with video creators, trying to get them to create exclusively on Facebook, and also heavily pushing video into people's feeds. If you remember, you know, Facebook videos, they're autoplay. So they start playing the minute you scroll past them. And not only that, but the way Facebook, so all video advertising is based on views, essentially. There are some kind of more more nuanced metrics, but on a general level, Facebook charges advertisers by how many people viewed a video. But Facebook, the threshold for a view was something like 2 seconds. So if you're just scrolling through your Facebook feed and a video starts playing automatically the moment you look at it, and you look at it for only 3 or 4 seconds and before you move on, that still counts as a view to Facebook. And Facebook actually got sued about this by brands because all these brands were saying, hey, we're paying for advertisements that no one's looking at. You're overcharging us. And Facebook lost that suit. So by virtue of that, it appeared that Jay had these huge viewership numbers on all the videos he was creating for Facebook. And he was making millions of dollars through their advertising revenue share program. But given all of those factors, it looks like those numbers were artificially inflated, as they were for a bunch of other creators. That's not exclusive to Jay.
Because that's definitely something which we see sort of time and time again, when creators who managed to ride the pivot to video wave were people who relied on knowing just a little bit more about how the algorithm actually worked than the high ups at advertising agencies. That's all they just needed to be like two pages ahead in the manual, and they were able to twist these numbers into something much more impressive than what they actually were.
So then from there, he becomes, you know, he's posting on Instagram a lot, you know, built a huge following there. But it turns out a lot of his Instagram content was plagiarized. And the thing that shocked me the most and that I still can't understand is that the information about Jay's plagiarism was out in the open for years before I came along and started this investigation. I don't understand how all of these reporters who wrote all these glowing profiles of Jay either totally ignored that or just kind of gave him a pass. This was before, you know, my piece came out or my investigation started before, you know, Claudine Gay, you know, the former president of Harvard, and, you know, plagiarism was very much in the news, at least here in the States. But you know, plagiarism is a serious accusation. And it was common knowledge on certain parts of YouTube that Jay was a serial plagiarist. And no one really decided to pursue that. Once I found the Nicole Arbour video about his plagiarism, that's when my investigation kind of really took off.
Can we talk a little bit about that then, like in terms of what you sort of found in your investigation? Because like from what, like reading it, there are like, there seems to be several things. First of all, there seems to sort of be ambiguity, if not like, well, different degrees of like ambiguity that may or may not be fabrication. And again, like, you know, being somewhat careful on this, but the ambiguity about his sort of like training as a monk, where it's sort of like, it's not entirely false, but like the way he presents it is very different from like what seemed to have actually happened based on like both his own blog posts and also other people. Also the, like, as you mentioned, like one of the things about like, you know, ripping off other people's like content and sort of feigning it off by saying, oh, we didn't know. And like, but that not really having any sort of major consequences. But yeah, like, I think as an overview, like, what did you find when you were doing this investigation that sort of kind of made it pass the line, I guess? Because I guess there's that thing about like, okay, is this guy just like a bit of a fabulist, but who on the, and I, you know, maybe one theory being like, well, you know, which online personality isn't a fabulist, and therefore like what constitutes as sort of being, what sets this fabulist apart? And I guess that's where the question is, like, what sets him apart at this point from everyone else in terms of like what he's saying and like what he's done?
So I go to the show. My suspicions are a little bit raised about Jay. So I start doing some research into his backstory. I find the Nicole Arbour video about his plagiarism. And my thought being, you know, the type of person who's going to plagiarize so brazenly, surely that type of person is probably dishonest about some other aspects of their life or engage in some other type of dishonest behavior. So I start to research a little bit more. And what really was instrumental in this investigation was actually Reddit. I found all of these Reddit threads from people who say, hey, I'm from London. I'm from Jay's religious community. He is not being honest about his history and who he is. And I chased a few of these people down and they include current and former ISKCON devotees from the UK, and they started to steer me in the right direction about what to look into and what parts of Jay's story just didn't make sense. So I start looking into his backstory, and the fundamental part of Jay's backstory is that he did not live a spiritual life, was not interested in spiritualism until one day he happened upon a lecture given by a Hindu monk named Gauranga Das. This lecture took place at Cass Business School, which is now Bayes Business School. It took place at Cass, which is part of the City University of London system, when Jay was 18, his first year in university. Literally the very first line of Jay's first book, his memoir / self-help guide, Think Like a Monk, is talking about this meeting he had when he was 18. So I start to look into that, but then I read some other interviews that Jay had done. And in all these different interviews, Jay changed the age at which this lecture occurred. Sometimes he said he was 18. Other times he said he was 19, 20, 21, 22. And you know, obviously those things are incompatible with one another. And it struck me as really bizarre that this guy couldn't seem to remember when the most transformative moment of his life occurred. You know, the way Jay describes it is that this changed the trajectory of his life irrevocably. He wasn't interested in, you know, again, he was going to go on to be a management consultant. He was going to be a good businessman, as was expected of him. But he was so moved by the talk of this holy man that he decides to follow him to India, and it sets him off on this spiritual path. And then he gets to where he is now. But the date when it happened is always changing, right? It's this moving target. So I go to Cass. I'm like, hey, by the way, do you have any record of this lecture taking place? And they're like, our records don't go back that far. I was like, okay. Couldn't find any record of it anywhere online. And to this day, it's not even clear that the lecture even took place. But what really kind of ticked me off is that I found Jay's Sanskrit name. And in doing so, I found these interviews with Jay put out by ISKCON in the Bhaktivedanta newsletter, Bhaktivedanta Manor. It's the ISKCON headquarters in Watford. And in this interview, Jay says that he has been involved with ISKCON ever since he was 14. His father was the accountant for ISKCON's Soho Street Temple in downtown London. And Jay had been going around the temple and attending ISKCON events and at ISKCON venues since his teen years. So this idea that he had never met a monk before and was completely unfamiliar with spiritual life until this fateful meeting with Gauranga Das at this lecture, whenever that supposedly happened, it's incompatible with what the truth is, which is that Jay was brought up in this faith. To some extent, he wasn't exactly interested when he was a teen, but, you know, it's a family thing for him.